Free trial now at evoice.com.
Islamic State militants on the verge of capturing a key town near Turkey, despite ramped up U.S. airstrikes. And the harrowing story of a young girl escaping the group's brutal treatment of women. Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff.
And I'm Gwen Ifill. Also ahead this Tuesday, the Supreme Court weighs whether Muslim inmates have the religious right to grow beards behind bars.
Plus, a portrait of a young man like you've never seen before, and the artist who transforms the National Mall in Washington into his canvas.
My idea is to change the reasons why portraits are made. It's to really explore portraiture in a very new way.
Those are some of the stories we're covering on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
At BAE Systems, our pride and dedication show in everything we do. From electronic systems to intelligence analysis and cyber operations. From combat vehicles and weapons to the maintenance and modernization of ships, aircraft, and critical infrastructure. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work.
BNSF Railway.
The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Alarms sounded in Ankara today over the peril facing a Kurdish town in Syria, just across the border from Turkey. Islamic State forces advance from two directions as Turkey's leaders press the U.S. for new action and the U.S. pressed Turkey to do more itself. After a night of heavy fighting, the black Islamic State flag still flew over part of Kobani this morning. Outgunned Kurdish defenders claimed they had blocked the militants from pushing into the town center. But in neighboring Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan told Syrian refugees he fears the worst.
Months have gone, but nothing is achieved. Right now, Kobani is about to fall.
The town lies a few hundred yards from Syria's border with Turkey. Its capture would help cement Islamic State control of northern Syria and pose a new threat to the Turks. The Islamic State advance has also triggered a mass exodus, with 200,000 people fleeing the Kobani area into Turkey. Airstrikes by the U.S.-led coalition are trying to break the militants' momentum in the region, but Erdogan said today it's not enough.
You cannot resolve this conflict with air bombardments. Now we are dealing with a new problem, Islamic State, a terrorist organization. This problem cannot be solved via airstrikes without cooperating with those fighting on the ground.
Later, a senior Turkish official said Ankara is asking Washington to step up its airstrikes. The response in Washington was noncommittal. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki.
Earlier, it's obviously horrific to watch what's going on the ground, but it's important for the United States, for us, to also step back and remember our strategic objectives as it relates to our efforts and our engagement in Syria.
Instead, Psaki said, U.S. officials are talking to the Turks about increasing their role in fighting the Islamic State group. Turkey does have tanks and ground troops stationed near the Syrian border. Last week, Turkish lawmakers authorized military action inside Syria. So far, nothing has happened. What's more, Turkish border forces have used armor and tear gas to block Kurdish militia fighters from crossing back into Syria to join the fight. All of which sparked protests today and clashes with police by Kurds in Turkish cities. And across Europe, Kurds in Paris and Brussels also appealed for action.
Nobody's doing anything. We are calling on humanity to stop this massacre against our people who are martyred, terrorized, killed.
Protesters in Brussels even forced their way into the European Parliament, waving flags and chanting in support of the Kurdish people.
We'll return to the Islamic State group and the horrors being inflicted on women under its control after the news summary.
U.S. health officials are considering stepping up airport screening for Ebola. New protocols could include checking for fever in all passengers arriving from abroad. In Atlanta, the head of the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Thomas Frieden, said today he is not yet ready to recommend anything so drastic.
Screening at airports, of course, would not have found fever in the patient in Dallas because he didn't have fever for 4 or 5 days after he arrived. But we'll look at all of the options. We're not today providing the steps that we plan to take, but I can assure you that we will be taking additional steps and we will be making those public in the coming days once we can work out the details.
That patient in Dallas, Thomas Duncan of Liberia, remained in critical condition, but hospital officials reported his liver function is improving.
Fear of Ebola spread in Spain today after a nursing assistant became the first person infected outside West Africa. We have a report from Neil Connery of Independent Television News, who's in Madrid tonight.
This is the hospital in Madrid, where a patient with Ebola was being treated. But one of the nurses somehow became infected here. And now that nurse, Teresa Romero, is being held in isolation in the very same hospital. Her husband is also in quarantine, and one other person is undergoing tests. Outside, some of the hospital's own staff have been demonstrating today, calling for more information about what went wrong.
It has been really surprising that this happened here with all of the security measures.
They have not provided any convincing information for us. I think they should provide more about what happened and what was the failure.
Hospital staff have told the newspaper, Al País, that their protective suits were not up to the standards set by the World Health Organization. They wore latex gloves sealed with duct tape and simple surgical masks, when staff say they should have worn full breathing apparatus. The director of public health in Spain said the nurse who contracted the virus entered the room of an Ebola victim twice, once while he was alive, and a second time to collect materials after he died. Teresa Romero is 40 years old and was transported between hospitals last night, although she's not thought to have left Madrid recently. Officials are so far monitoring more than 20 people who came into contact with her. The World Health Organization have said while governments are well prepared, the spread of Ebola in Europe is, in their words, quite unavoidable.
The case in Spain also claimed another victim. A Madrid court ordered that the infected nurse's dog must be euthanized and the remains incinerated. Some research indicates dogs can be infected with Ebola without showing symptoms, but it's unclear if they can transmit it to humans. On Wall Street, worries about global economic growth sent stocks into a deep dive. The sell-off started after Germany reported weaker industrial output and the International Monetary Fund shaved its growth forecast. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 272 points to close at 16,719. The Nasdaq fell 60 points to close at 4385, and the S&P 500 dropped 29 to finish at 1935.
A federal appeals court threw out gay marriage bans in Idaho and Nevada today. It came a day after the U.S. Supreme Court effectively legalized same-sex unions in 11 other states. All told, the practice will now be legal in 32 states.
Another federal appeals court has struck down part of the congressional map in Virginia. A panel of three judges agreed that Republicans created a black majority district for purposes of racial gerrymandering. The ruling does not affect next month's election, but state lawmakers will have to redraw the lines next year.
And former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner appeared in federal court in Washington to defend the bailout of AIG. The government gave the insurance giant an $85 billion loan in 2008. Geithner testified today it was necessary to save the financial system. A lawsuit by AIG's former top executive charges the deal cheated shareholders. Still to come on the NewsHour, women and children in the grips of Islamic State militants. Do Muslim inmates have the right to grow beards in U.S. prisons? a Nobel Prize in physics for improving the light bulb, how voice control phones distract drivers, a portrait best viewed from the sky, and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's call for more women to get involved in public life.
We return now to the Islamic State group and its brutal tactics. Much is known now about the group, also known as ISIL, and its high-profile beheadings of Westerners, mass executions of civilians, and forced conversions. Less well-known is the extremist group's horrific treatment of women and girls. Last week, the United Nations reported thousands of women had been abducted by the group, some handed over to fighters as a reward or sold as sex slaves. The NewsHour sent a crew to meet a 15-year-old girl, a member of the Yazidi sect, who was captured and held by the Islamic State before managing to escape. She now lives at a camp with others who've been displaced. We withheld her identity for her and her family's safety.
They kept us in a house, the girls and the woman, and then they killed all the men, including my brother.
She and the abducted women were taken by truck east to a house in Mosul. There, they were ordered to convert to Islam. More kidnapped girls joined them.
They separated the women and the girls. Some of the girls were taken by ISIL. They gave some of us to the guards and they sold some of us too. And some were given as a gift. If we didn't do what they asked, they would have hit us. We did everything because we were threatened. We had to. They were very bad to the girls. They were doing bad things to the women, illegal things.
That's only one story. To help us understand the depth and the scale of the Islamic State's treatment of women and girls, we turn to Manal Omar, acting vice president for the Middle East and Africa Center at the United States Institute of Peace, and David Jacobson, professor of sociology and founding director of the Citizenship Initiative on Civil Society and Conflict at the University of South Florida. David Jacobson, you wrote that women are now at the heart of the world's most dangerous quarrel. What do you mean when you say dangerous quarrel?
Well, I think that women's status and women's sexuality has become the hinge of very different perspectives of society and very different perspectives of morality. The Islamist groups in general and the jihadi groups in particular, the more violent jihadi groups, see the West and under the force of globalization as being a very corrupting force. There's a backlash, in essence, against that corrupting force, sometimes violent, extremely violent in the case of ISIS, and other times lesser.
Manal Omar, has ISIS proven to be more dangerous on this front than other similar groups?
I think that you've seen an increased level of brutality, but what's actually frightening is that they're very strategic in targeting women. It's a, you know, wonderful way of really forcing communities into submission. And I think the strategy behind the targeting of women is what's really particularly scary from the ISIS. I think that we've seen in the past, that sexual violence is often used as a tool of war, and it's a very effective tool of war, and it's something that they're adopting to be able to force communities into control.
But I guess, is this unusual? Is this something, as horrible as it is it something we've seen in past wars, in past conflicts?
I think the reality is that you've always seen women targeted, and you've seen, various UN resolutions. UN Resolution 1820 specifically identifies sexual violence as a tool of war. But dating back to UN Resolution 1325, which was in 2000, which, admitted that women bear the brunt of war, I think that there's a trend that we've seen in terms of really exploiting, but particularly the use of sexual violence. It's a way of not only targeting the individual women, targeting the families, but also targeting the community. So it's not something that's new, but ISIS has taken it to a very brutal level. And what we've seen is that they're not only using it as a way of, targeting communities, but they're also using it as a way of creating a reward system with soldiers, as well as an income generating in terms of selling and human trafficking.
And yet, David Jacobson, we hear a lot or a fair bit about the beheadings and the executions and even mass bombings, but we don't hear as much about this kind of violence. Why is that?
It is puzzling, and I think that's beginning to change slowly, and it's puzzling on two levels. One is the sheer scale of this violence against women, and secondly, the centrality of explaining what is going on. So when ISIS and other jihadi groups across the world ideologically are, one could say, obsessed around the issue of women, and so the targeting of women has got a strategic objective in terms of frightening populations, but it's also very symbolic. And it's important to point out the categories of women in terms of who they target. So much of the rape, for example, has targeted either what would they term people of the book, minorities, Christians, and other minorities like the Yazidis, whereas among Sunnis, women who they feel have gone apostates of some kind is generally being executed.
Manal Omar, because of this, because of the particular cultural shame that is visited on these women who are the victims, are these likely to go underreported or unreported?
Of course. I mean, you know, reporting sexual violence, even in this country, in America, 60% of sexual violence goes unreported. And you can only imagine how much that's enhanced with the cultural ramifications, but also the fact that the communities have no tools of really being able to reintegrate if they are able to bring the girls back. And I think that that's one of the primary challenges. We've heard on the ground reports of women who have escaped, who commit suicide in order not to have to face that reintegration or face their families and community.
David Jacobson, how do we confirm the numbers? How do we confirm the scale and the scope of this kind of violence? Is there any way?
Well, if one looks at the United Nations report, which you referred to earlier, what they indicate is they can just get at a certain minimum baseline in the cases they report. We have to assume that the number of cases is much worse than what we're reading. And no, I think to get a precise count would be near impossible, but we know it is very, very bad.
Is that in part because of the taboo associated with this kind of crime?
Certainly, and this is one of the tragedies of what is happening, is that the women who are raped, sexually assaulted, forced into marriages, in these honor cultures, they're now dishonored, and this is not something that they necessarily going to advertise or report on, and it's compounded by issues, for example, if they become pregnant. It's a very severe situation for these individuals.
Manal Omar, if we consider the possibility, the horrible possibility that rape and sexual assault have gone mainstream as a tool of war, I wonder at what point that human trafficking also has become part of this, or whether it's a separate issue.
I think that it is an integrated issue. You know, what you're seeing, again, is based on a reward system, based on selling. It's all tied and integrated together. I think one of the primary challenges is really being able to identify it as terrorist attacks. These are attacks that are used to cause terror, to cause, again, submission of communities. And, you know, until we're able to really recognize that as that and not just a humanitarian issue or something that affects women, I think it'll be very difficult for us to combat the issue that's being arising in terms of sexual violence as a tool of war. Again, ISIS is very strategic in that use, and it's something that we have to think strategically about as well to counter their narrative.
And what is the international community's responsibility in that?
I think that one of the primary issue is better documentation. As you mentioned, there's a taboo and underreporting, but there's also a failure for us to acknowledge the hard side of the use of sexual violence in terms of security. We continue to see it as a softer side, as a humanitarian side, and so we're not documenting it. We're not able to really be responsive to it. And I think particularly to really highlighting the awareness of it. I mean, the Islamic State is using religious justifications, and I think that the more the population is aware that this is not tied to religion, it strips away any claim that they have in terms of the false name of Islamic State.
Manal Omar of the U.S. Institute of Peace and David Jacobson of the University of South Florida, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Online, you can hear more from the 15-year-old girl who escaped from Islamic State group militants. You can watch that on our world page at pbsnewshour.org.
Thank you.
The new Supreme Court term kicked off today with a case about the religious freedoms of prison inmates. Should Muslim inmates be allowed to grow beards for religious reasons, or does that pose a significant security risk to prison guards? That was the question posed to the Supreme Court today. We start with a look at the case at the center of today's arguments. It comes from Tim O'Brien, who filed this report for the PBS program Religion and Ethics News Weekly. And a warning, it contains some graphic images and details.
It was a burglary and stabbing at this trailer in the wee hours of a May morning 5 years ago that led to Tuesday's Supreme Court case. The perpetrator, 33-year-old Gregory Holt. The victim, his ex-girlfriend. He slashed her throat and stabbed her in the chest, telling her, "If I can't have you, no one will." She survived, but Holt was sentenced to life in prison after jurors learned of his long criminal history, including written threats to kidnap President Bush's daughters and blow up federal buildings. He's being held at this maximum security prison at Grady, Arkansas, about 70 miles southeast of Little Rock. Years before the offense, Holt converted to Islam. He now goes by the name of Abdul Malik Muhammad. He's challenging prison regulations that prohibit facial hair, saying a half-inch beard is a requirement of his Muslim faith. Criminals do give up many of their rights when they enter prison, but not all of them. In fact, in 2000, President Clinton signed legislation that prohibits any restrictions on the religious liberty of prison inmates unless the restriction can be shown to be in furtherance of a compelling governmental interest and that it is the least restrictive means of furthering that interest. After two lower courts ruled against him, Holt, or Abdul Muhammad, mailed a 15-page handwritten petition to the U.S. Supreme Court, challenging the prison grooming policy as a violation of that 2000 federal law. "This is a matter of grave importance," wrote Holt, "pitting the rights of Muslim inmates against a system that is hostile to these views." When, to the surprise of many, the court announced last March that it would hear Holt's appeal, the case took on a life of its own. The Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, a public interest law firm devoted to promoting religious freedom, got involved. It lined up attorney Douglas Laycock, an experienced Supreme Court advocate and one of the country's leading authorities on church-state issues, to represent Holt in the high court.
The important point here is that this is not just about him. This is about all those other prisoners that Congress learned about that were not getting their scriptures, not getting their dietary needs, not getting the other things essential to religious practice.
Attorneys for the state of Arkansas declined our request for an interview, as did corrections officials, nor would they allow us any access to the inmate, Gregory Holt. Holt's case has generated considerable support from groups that have long been at war on church-state issues. More than a dozen front-of-the-court briefs representing nearly 100 organizations have been filed in Holt's behalf. Only one in support of Arkansas, filed on behalf of 15 states, saying courts should defer to corrections officials on such matters. After his arrest and incarceration, Holt continued to write threatening letters from prison. "Death to America," he wrote in one letter, describing himself as an American Taliban in another.
"If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven."
But Obama's Justice Department is also backing this self-proclaimed jihadist in this case, characterizing the prison security concerns as exaggerated or based on mere speculation.
This is the first Supreme Court test of the federal law designed to preserve the religious freedom of prison inmates, and it raises an important question. If the law does not protect the right of a prison inmate to grow a beard against claims of prison security, dismissed by so many as so weak, what does it protect?
So how did today's arguments play out at the Supreme Court? Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal was there, and she joins us now. So, Marcia, this is quite a case, quite an interesting set of arguments, Q&A, questions and answers before the justices. And this is an inmate who has some legal heavyweights on his side.
He does. He has one of the foremost religion clause scholars in the country representing him in the arguments today. This law, it's important to know, it really erects a very high hurdle for the government any government body here, a prison system, before it can burden somebody's religious expression. It says the government body has to have a compelling interest, has to choose the least restrictive means to further that interest. But it also says, Congress said in the law, you have to give due deference to the experience and expertise of prison officials. It didn't say how much deference. And those two commands are in tension, and that tension played out during the argument.
And that's what Arkansas was arguing here. So what was the argument they made?
Mr. Holt's lawyer argued that Arkansas is looking for absolute deference to their judgment that the no-beard policy protects security within the prison system. And he faced little pushback from some of the justices. The Chief Justice said, well, a half-inch beard may be an easy case, but the next case that comes along is going to be a one-inch beard, and then it's going to be a full beard. And we have to make a decision based on a generally applicable standard here. Where is the limit on deference? And Mr. Holt's lawyer said, well, Arkansas has, any government body, has to provide evidence, concrete examples that there's a material effect on security that wasn't done here. Well, Arkansas counters here. The state's attorney says, look, if the no-beard policy protects against prisoners altering their appearance if they escape, or even altering it within the prison so that they can get into areas they shouldn't be in, and also it protects against the hiding of contraband, even in a half-inch beard.
And it sounds as if the justices are skeptical of some of the arguments the Arkansas
They were. In fact, Justice Alito kind of poked fun a little bit at the Arkansas lawyer, saying, well, you know, why not just have them comb the half-inch beard and something as small as a SIM card might fall out, or even a revolver.
A tiny revolver. So this is a case where you got some sense of the justices being skeptical.
You did. It seems as though the prisoner may have the better argument here. But it's an important case, Judy, because this is really the first time the court has looked at how to apply this law. It's a sister law to what we saw last term in the Hobby Lobby case and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which we learned protects government from burdening the religious expression of corporations and their religious owners. So it's a very important law.
And you also get to hear all the most interesting cases.
I do. The facts are always interesting.
The facts are always. Marcia Coyle, we thank you.
My pleasure, Judy.
The Nobel Prize in Physics is often awarded to work that can be tough to explain to anyone who isn't actually a physicist. But this year's winners announced earlier today one for research that actually affects our everyday lives. Jeffrey Brown has the story.
A trio of scientists won for the invention of blue light-emitting diodes, often referred to as LEDs. The blue LEDs, first created in the early 90s, paved the way for brighter and more energy-efficient white lights, the kind now seen on the screens of phones, TVs, and computers, even signs on the subway. Two of the scientists were from Japan, one from the U.S. Our science correspondent, Miles O'Brien, joins me now from Boston to tell us about it. So, Miles, the invention of blue light-emitting diodes, what exactly does that mean?
Well, we had red and we had green, and we needed blue to take it over the top. Let's step back for a little bit. Back in the 60s, when they created the first light-emitting diodes, red was the first one because it was the easiest to make. The semiconducting material that makes that particular color was much easier to make in an efficient way. Then came green, and you can think about the first calculator you got, which was always with a red light-emitting diode, and eventually we got into green. But blue was difficult because the material that creates that particular color, that wavelength, was hard to work with. Gallium nitride was the tricky thing that was difficult for scientists and engineers to efficiently turn into the crystals to mass produce. But once you have red, green, and blue, put them together, you have white light, and that has created a revolution.
Well, that is the word that the Nobel Committee used, revolutionizing lighting. So it has seeped into all facets of life.
Well, think about the incandescent light bulb, which is just a hot glowing filament in a vacuum tube. Then we went to fluorescent lights, much more efficient. And now we're in the world of LEDs, which if you go back to the incandescent bulb, comparing it, 20 times more efficient and last much longer. You know, a quarter of the energy on our planet is spent in creating light. And in order to reduce all of our need for energy and our carbon footprint, LEDs make a huge, significant impact.
You know, it's interesting. The Academy also said that this year's prize is very specifically more for invention than discovery. We often look at these prizes, especially in something like physics, as going for more basic research.
Yes, of course, last year they honored the Professor Higgs of the Higgs boson, the God particle, if you will, which takes us right back to the very origins of everything, the Big Bang. But difficult to say that has any real world application, except that it helps us understand where we all came from. This is applied science at its best. And if you look back to what Alfred Nobel wanted when he created this prize, it was something that had huge impact on humanity and how we live. And certainly the LED light has done that.
That's what he wanted, but it doesn't usually come out that way, at least in immediate practical responses from the work, right?
Yeah, no, frankly, for those of us on the outside of the world of physics, sometimes it's hard to decipher
exactly
what happened,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because we're talking about very esoteric things, and it takes a little bit of work to understand the significance. In this case, we all immediately know, wow, that LED light, which is on my smartphone, which powers my battery, which is changing the way street lighting works, is changing things in the third world in very significant ways, where people are turning in kerosene lanterns for LED lights. It's had a huge impact, and it's only really just begun in some ways.
Now, let me just, in our last minute or so here, let's turn to yesterday's announcement, which was the prize for medicine. This was described as a kind of GPS system for the brain, using another kind of technology that we're all now familiar with, but applying it to brain research.
Yeah, the award was split between three scientists, two of them, two teams. The first bit of research goes back a while to the discovery that the hippocampus, part of our brain, is what maps our orientation. They actually looked inside a rodent's brain as it was moving around a room and could see when it was in any particular place, a specific part of the brain would sort of light up, if you will. That was further enhanced by a married couple team from Norway, which found a neighboring region of the brain where we actually have the ability to set up sort of a grid system, which allows us to remember where we parked the car, for example, mm-hmm. to give us kind of a spatial orientation. And in looking at the way the rats navigate and seeing what their brains are doing, they really understand how this works. What's really exciting about all of this is where we first see the early signs of Alzheimer's disease. And understanding what's going on with this part of the brain might help us, first of all, diagnose sooner, and also might help us understand Alzheimer's in a more meaningful way where we could provide some treatments.
All right. So this prize really is for potential looking forward to some spectacular work in the future, perhaps, right?
One would hope, but it's really interesting to understand how our brain has the ability to kind of create its own, you know, we say in our mind's eye. This is our mind's eye.
All right. Miles O'Brien, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In the age of mobile phones and smart devices, today's drivers are increasingly tempted to take their hands off the wheel and their eyes off the road. Many of us take comfort in newer hands-free technology that allows us to stay connected but with fewer hand and eye movements. But a new study out today finds talking, texting, and changing the radio dial, even without using your hands, may not necessarily make driving any safer. Such distractions, in fact, may make the process of getting from here to there more dangerous. The study was conducted by AAA and the University of Utah. Jake Nelson is the director of traffic safety advocacy and research for AAA, and he joins me now. So how distracted are we, Jake Nelson?
It's a lot worse than we thought.
Yeah.
You know, it's really important to remember that the auto industry has done a great job at helping to mitigate manual and visual forms of distracted driving by allowing motorists to keep their hands on the wheel and their eyes on the road. Our concern at AAA is that there's the third leg of the stool here, which is the mental or cognitive piece that also needs to be addressed.
And so technology may be hurting more than it's helping?
Well, certainly from a mental standpoint, using voice commands to do things like tune the radio and to send and receive text messages and the latter are actually more distracting than, from a mental standpoint, than using your handheld device.
Okay, now first, I'm going to make an admission here. My very first car, my very first accident was because I was switching the radio dial. Why is that not more distracting than everything we're talking about now?
Well, there are different forms of distracted driving, as I mentioned. There's the manual, which is the example that you just gave. There's also the visual, looking away from the roadway. But if your mind isn't focused on the important task of driving, our performance as drivers decreases.
So rank the kind of tasks. Some of the new cars, you can write an email while you're driving. You can obviously talk on the phone. You can do all kinds of things. You can call people up. Is that, or which of those are more dangerous than the other?
We looked at a variety of tasks that motorists engage in while driving, from listening to an audiobook in the radio, driving just by itself, talking to a passenger, talking on a cell phone, handheld or hands-free, and interacting with these voice recognition systems to send and receive text messages. And we found that just driving in and of itself has a significant amount of workload associated with it, which makes sense. We're doing a lot of different things at one time. When you start to listen to the radio and an audiobook, it's not much more distracting than just driving.
Right.
Talk about using a cell phone, handheld or hands-free. That's a category 2 on our scale of 1 to 5.
Right.
Interacting with these voice-to-text systems, category 3.
So it matters what layer of technology we're talking about. So if I'm trying to find an address and my technology device and my built into my car gives me the wrong answer to the question I've asked, I'm even more distracted.
Absolutely. In our research, we found some good news and some bad news. All right. The good news is that some automakers are getting it right. Toyota, for example, their Intune system, interacting with that isn't really much more distracting, at least from a mental standpoint, than listening to an audiobook. And there's reason for that. So they have blocked certain functionality in their system, like composing a text message or an email, which in and of itself reduces the demands on a driver by about half.
While you're driving. You
while
can
you're
do it
driving.
While you're sitting still.
Correct.
So, but here's the question for me, which is, what can you do about that? Should AAA be recommending to car companies or to motorists that we just shouldn't be doing any of that?
Well, I think we have a shared responsibility here. I think that industry has a responsibility to do whatever they can to make sure that the products that they develop are as safe as possible to use. And we've identified through our research several ways that industry can pursue that. And then there's obviously a responsibility that all of us have. Just because technology enables us to do things behind the wheel doesn't mean that we should do it. So hang up the phone, drive, focus on that very important task.
Just because you can put on your mascara while driving
right.
doesn't mean you should do it.
Exactly.
But is there a connection that's been made or that you can establish between these kinds of activities and actual accidents?
That's a really good question. So there's been a lot of research that's been done looking at different forms of distracted driving. And the example that I would give you would be talking on a cell phone. Regardless of whether it's handheld or hands-free, previous research has shown that that roughly quadruples your risk of causing a traffic crash. On our scale of mental distraction, that came in at a category level 2. When we talk about interacting with these voice-to-text systems, even a perfect system in our research, one that never made a mistake in translation or understanding a voice command, was a category 3.
But you're talking extrapolation. I'm wondering whether there's actual evidence that there were 500 accidents last year, and the drivers admitted later that they were trying to talk to Siri.
Yeah, so this relationship between mental distraction and actual crashes isn't well understood.
Mm.
No one has researched it to date, including AAA. Our study wasn't designed to look at crash risk, but we have a study that we're going to initiate next year that will help us to understand this relationship a little bit better.
So as a result, you can't really advise automakers or consumers to not do these things at all?
Not exactly correct, because we know in the research that we have done, which looked at the effect of mental workload or mental distraction on driving performance, that being overloaded as a driver by the use of technologies or doing other things while driving impairs your performance behind the wheel. So it increases your reaction time. People who are mentally distracted tend to scan the roadway less to look for hazards, and worse, outcome possible is just failure to identify hazards in the roadway altogether. It's a phenomenon called inattention blindness.
So you don't even see the squirrel.
You're looking straight ahead and you don't even see it.
I think I've had that happen. So I'm going to go now, plug in my GPS before I drive off.
There you go.
Jake Nelson, AAA Director of Traffic Safety Advocacy and Research. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now to a new public art installation in the nation's capital that is both huge in size and meaning. Jeffrey Brown takes us there.
It's called A Facescape, a portrait of a young man in the very heart of the National Mall in Washington that can be seen in full only from the top of the Washington Monument or from the sky above. Starting small, it built up like a snowball over 6 acres. Taking 4 weeks of construction and requiring 2,000 tons of sand, 800 tons of soil, 10,000 pegs, and miles of twine.
What we don't use, we'll just take out.
It's the work of Jorge Rodriguez Harada and was commissioned by the National Portrait Gallery. And indeed, the artist conceived of it as a portrait that would, like much of his work, explore the question of identity.
Identity is an amazing thing. What we look like is what people will judge immediately when they see you. And that's something that you're born with it, and it follows you for the rest of your life. My idea is to change the reasons why portraits are made. It's to really explore portraiture in a very new way.
Right.
Curator Taina Carragall says Rodriguez Harada is doing just that.
We conceive of it as a face, but a portrait can be much more than a face. He is working on what we could think of as a land art of the 21st century with satellite technology, with dirt and sand. This is an ephemeral artwork, so that's also something that goes partly against the tradition of portraiture, which is a genre used to memorialize people.
The installation on the National Mall between the Lincoln and the World War II memorials is actually a composite created from close to 50 photographs the artist took of young men aged 18 to 25 around Washington. And it is very much an American portrait titled Out of Many, One, E Pluribus Unum. It also plays off another idiom, that of marketing.
This face represents the celebration of diversity. And I think that diversity is what was one of the things that makes the nation so great. The idea is to use the same ideas of scale and position and everything else used in marketing, but for completely different reasons. Not to sell you anything, but to let us contemplate the idea of identity.
Rodriguez Harada, 48, was born in Cuba and raised in New Jersey. His early work in the 1990s was subversive, altering billboards in ways that question the motives and methods of advertisers, especially in urban areas.
It's funny that you started out doing essentially illegal type work, and then here you are standing on the National Mall, asked to do this.
Well,
is it not ironic for you?
During that time, we were able to get enough of that work done that tobacco advertising was taken off from billboards.
Oh, yeah?
When I was doing that, it was because I really thought it was awful, you know. I wasn't hurting anyone, and the dialogue was to hopefully, you know, get some of that stuff stopped.
The first large facescape he tackled was titled Expectation, a giant sand painting in the likeness of then-candidate Barack Obama, created on a Barcelona beach. In 2013, in Belfast, he created Wish, the United Kingdom's largest portrait ever, spread over 11 acres, this time of an anonymous girl. And in Amsterdam, a human rights activist, part of a campaign defending women targeted for their work in Central America. This one spanned almost 2 football fields.
I can only work big if it's intrinsic to the message. Working big doesn't make any sense unless what you're saying is really important as well. So the only things I've ever done big were big things to talk about.
You mean big ideas require big space?
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're going to give something a wow factor like this.
This has a wow factor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's very difficult to do anything on a National Mall. And for the Park Service and a trust for the National Mall and the Smithsonian to all work together, then Clark Construction, Topcon. I mean, a lot of things have to come together for something like this to happen. And it did.
On the ground, as Rodriguez Herrada showed us, visitors experienced the work as though in a maze.
So where are we now?
We're now in the eyebrow.
You've got this face in your head.
This is completely memorized in my head. I know exactly where I am at all times.
Private companies donated their services to install the work, which involved advanced technology along with all that soil and sand. Laura Walks of Clark Construction.
Jorge designed it on the computer and sent it to the surveying company that made his drawing into data points that we could put out into the world, onto this field. And from that, our surveyors are working with little GPS computers.
The installation comes at a time when the National Mall is in the midst of a major restoration project. The removal of damaged soil, installing a new irrigation system, and planting new grass. The Facescape project is now part of that process. At the end of this month, the soil and sand will be tilled back into the ground. In many ways, National Mall and Park Superintendent Bob Vogel says the artwork is perfect for this premier civic space.
This is a place where people come and they grieve, they celebrate, they demonstrate. We want people to look at it and get people to think and to talk about it.
It's a face with a short life, soon to be erased, with hopes that its component parts and meaning live on.
To hear more from Jorge Rodriguez Herrada and see his other facescapes, go to our ArtBeat page at pbsnewshour.org.
Finally tonight, we're joined by the junior senator from New York State, Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand. During her tenure, she's focused on fighting sexual assault in the military and on college campuses. Senator Gillibrand recently published a new book, Off the Sidelines, Raise Your Voice, Change the World. Senator Gillibrand, welcome to the NewsHour.
I'm delighted to be on.
So you say in the introduction that, among other things, what you want to do in writing this book was to get young women and girls to believe in themselves just as much as men and boys do. So my question is, you're saying that in 2014, when we've had three women secretaries of state, we have a woman head of the Federal Reserve Bank, we've got 20 women in the Senate, and so on and so on, that women still need to have a lesson in how to have confidence in themselves.
Well, it's even more than that. It's just telling women how important their voices are, that their life experiences, their views, how they feel about an issue isn't necessarily being heard at all these decision-making tables, whether it's a boardroom where we only have 16% women, or CEOs where there's only 3%, or Congress where there's only 20 women. That any woman, if she expresses her views, if she's heard on what she cares about, she can change the outcome, whether it's the PTA meeting or whether it's in Congress.
It's kind of a self-help book, and you even say that in here. Is that unusual for a United States senator to be writing a self-help book?
Well, I wanted to write the kind of book that I like to read. I really love reading biographies and memoirs that tell me how a woman got from A to B, how she made those decisions, what were the challenges, what's her life advice. And so I made a point to include details and stories as mere anecdotes so that a woman can not only see herself, see her own challenges, but realize how important her aspirations are and that her hopes and dreams are important, and that if she's heard, she can actually change how decisions are made and what the outcomes actually are.
One of the things you write about in the book, and this has gotten a lot of attention, is the sexism you've encountered in your career, including all the way to the United States Senate. You at one point describe a comment from a man, and you say he was, quote, one of your favorite older members of the Senate, who, after you had had a baby, he looked at you and he said, don't lose too much weight, quote, I like my girls chubby. How did you respond?
I just smiled. That was a point in my career where I'm quite senior. So I shared these stories as anecdotes so women can understand when they're experiencing something like this in the workplace. Not only does it not have to define them, but they can push their way through it to elevate the conversation, to talk about some of the larger challenges we face. And I share some stories about when I was younger in my career where those kind of comments really hurt, where I felt like I was being judged not on my work, not on my efforts, but on my looks. And when you're a young 20-something lawyer, you don't have the tools. You don't know what to do with that. But I felt undermined. And so I want that reader to say, I'm not alone. I can not only push through this and someday be that guy's boss, but It's something that doesn't have to define me.
Do you think this is an issue mainly with an older generation of men, of members of Congress, or is this with younger men as well?
I think it stems from the same problem of, are we valuing women in the workplace? Are we valuing women at home? Are we valuing women's work wherever it's taking place? And when you're looking at this challenge with the NFL and women aren't being valued, when you're looking at challenges with sexual assault in the military or sexual assault on college campuses, victims aren't being believed, survivors are being blamed, it all goes to this notion of, are we valuing women? And then you combine that with the fact that we're making 78 cents on the dollar for the same work as our male colleagues, that's problematic. And so my anecdote to this is, if women can be heard and have their opinions be heard in these decision-making places, you can change outcomes.
Just quickly, you mentioned the sexual assaults in the military. You worked very hard on that issue. You got over 50 votes, but it still wasn't enough. Is this something, this is basically taking charges of sexual assault out of the chain of command. Is this something that has really had its moment?
No, this is just the beginning. And with a lot of these battles, when you're talking about basic civil rights, civil liberties, when you're talking about equality, these can be generational battles. And sexual assault in the military, I believe, in order to have transparency and accountability, you have to take the decision-making out of the chain of command, give it to the hands of trained military prosecutors who have no skin in the game, who don't have biases. And if we can continue to push for that reform, we will have a stronger military for it. But that's an example, and I shared in the book, of where survivors' voices were heard, whether they're men or women. This is what they are calling to happen, that they need transparency and accountability to have any hope of justice.
A question about women, about the midterm elections are just a few weeks away now. Democrats clearly benefit most of the time from the women's vote. People talk about the gender gap. But it is also the case that men vote most of the time, majority of them do, for Republicans. Don't Democrats have a problem with the men's vote? And if that's the case, why?
I don't think so. I think this election is going to be about who we fight for. And we are fighting to make sure that people get equal pay for equal work. We're fighting for basic social safety nets to make sure everyone has a chance to reach their full potential. And all of these ideals, I think, are going to determine the outcome of these elections. And I think our candidates are stronger. And I think that's going to show by holding the Senate and continuing to have victories in the House as well.
I want to ask you about what former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is saying in his book that is just out. Among other things, he's critical of President Obama's leadership in foreign affairs. He says he, quote, too often avoids the battle, complains, and misses opportunities. Does Leon Panetta have a point?
Well, you know, in my job as the overseer of the Armed Services Committee and also as part of Congress, that I think should be engaged and involved in whether we are declaring war and what kind of military engagements take place, I voted most recently against the president's idea to arm rebels because I didn't think it would be successful, and I was concerned with the unintended consequences. I didn't have faith that these so-called moderates wouldn't hand the weapon over to the better fighter the minute the battle got tough. And I don't want those weapons to be used against our men and women. But I also believe the president does need authorization to engage in bombing in Syria. I don't think the existing authorizations for Iraq and fighting al-Qaeda is sufficient for the missions he's having in Syria right now. So I'm of the view that he needs to come to Congress and ask for that authorization before he continues this particular strategy.
But is Leon Panetta right when he says the president holds back?
Well, Secretary Panetta was in his cabinet, so he has his own views. My job is to provide oversight over the administration, and in this particular issue, I think he should be coming to Congress for authorization.
All right. A couple of other questions I want to ask you for our website, but for now, thank you, Senator Kirsten
You're welcome.
Gillibrand.
Again, the major developments of the day. Turkey warned that Islamic State militants are on the verge of capturing a key Kurdish town just over the border inside Syria. The World Health Organization warned that more cases of Ebola in Europe are, quote, unavoidable after a nursing assistant in Spain became infected. And worries about global growth sent Wall Street into a deep dive. The Dow Industrials lost 270 points.
On the NewsHour online right now, armed with a camera and some one-inch LED lights, Minnesota artist Brian Hart creates stunning mosaics in the darkness of night. By using long film exposures, Hart draws with the light. See what the end results look like in a video produced by Twin Cities Public Television. That is on ArtBeat. All that and much more on our website, newshour.pbs.org.
And again to our honor roll of American service personnel killed in the Afghanistan conflict. We add them as their deaths are made official and photographs become available. Here in silence is one more. And that's the news hour for tonight. On Wednesday, we take you inside the CDC's war room in the fight to contain Ebola. I'm Gwen Ifill.
And I'm Judy Woodruff. We'll see you online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us here at the PBS News Hour, thank you and good night.
Major funding for the PBS News Hour has been provided by our economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us. And by BAE Systems, inspired work. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting science, technology, and improved economic performance and financial literacy in the 21st century. And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.